Welcome to
America's Cannabis Conversation,
where you can hear experts from all facets of the cannabis business as to what's happening in this exploding industry. Keep yourself informed. Join the conversation. Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation Weekly Quick News. I'm your host, Dan Perkins. New Jersey Assembly approves marijuana decriminalization bill ahead of legalization referendum. The New Jersey Assembly approved a marijuana decriminalization bill. The legislation, which would make possession of up to 2 ounces of cannabis a civil penalty punishable by a $50 fine and no jail time, cleared the chamber in a 63-10 vote with 5 abstentions. This comes days after the legislation advanced out of the Community Development and Affairs Committee. As a November referendum on broader marijuana legalization approaches, legislatures have pushed for the modest reform in the interim. Interest in enacting decriminalization has increased amid protests over racial injustice, with advocates arguing that cannabis criminalization contributes to disparities in the criminal justice system. Under the proposal, possession of more than 2 ounces but less than 1 pound would be punishable by up to 6 months in prison or up to $1,000 fine for the first offense. Washington, D.C. FDA warning letter causes company to recall injectable CBD products. A Food and Drug Administration letter warning a company about its marketing of injectable CBD products has led to a voluntary recall that the federal agency announced this past week. Biosciences received the letter last month, with FDA directing the firm to cease sales of its line of CBD vials, which it makes as a pain reliever that serves as an alternative to opioids and can help with detoxification. The agency said the company was violating federal statutes both by engaging in interstate commerce of an unapproved new drug and failing to properly label the products by neglecting to include directions for use. Injectable drug products can pose a serious risk of harm to users because they deliver directly into the bloodstream and bypass many of the body's natural defenses against toxic ingredients. Toxins or dangerous organisms that can lead to serious and life-threatening conditions, such as sepsis, the FDA wrote in their cease and desist order. Boulder, Colorado. Do highly potent marijuana concentrates get users more high? Not exactly, a recent study found. High-potency marijuana concentrates on today's legal markets can contain upwards of 90% THC, so one might reasonably expect them to pack a greater psychological punch than a typical flower, which tops out at about 30%. But that may not be the case, according to a new study out of the University of Colorado at Boulder. Researchers found that while THC blood levels spiked after users consumed concentrate, impairment levels did not significantly differ from participants who used flower. Surprisingly, we found that potency did not track with intoxication levels, said the lead author, Cinnamon Bidwell, an assistant professor at Colorado University Institute of Cognitive Science. While we saw striking differences in blood levels between the two groups, they were similarly impaired. Most neurobehavioral measures were not altered by short-term cannabis consumption, the study found. And our final story comes from Los Angeles. LA enforcement's targeting of illicit cannabis operators suffers a setback from COVID-19 fallout and budget cuts. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted cannabis enforcement initiatives in Los Angeles and caused critical budget shortfalls that could further hinder efforts to crack down on unlicensed marijuana operators. That 1-2 punch could present a major obstacle for the success of the LA legal market. Reducing the number of illicit cannabis sellers and growers in Los Angeles has long been a top priority for licensed businesses, which say they cannot compete on pricing since legal recreational sales took in effect in January of 2018. Part of the problem, a push to enforce new ordinances targeting landlords and property owners of unlicensed cannabis shops, has been on hold since March. That's when many city services and offices were shuttered to mitigate the protection for COVID-19 cases in Los Angeles County. But there is hope the situation could turn around sooner rather than later, and the so-called padlock ordinance can be enforced. This has been your American Cannabis Conversation Quick News. I'm Dan Perkins. Thanks for listening. Let's see who's joining us in the conversation this week. First off is Dr. Jordan Tischler, our cannabis doctor on call, and he's going to deal with COVID-19 and its impact on the mental health of our country. Next up is an interview with Brent Zettel, who is doing a study on the impact of cannabis on treatment for COVID-19. Next, we have Morgan Fox, our legislative liaison for the National Cannabis Industry Association, and he's going to talk about changes in the law for cannabis business deductions. And finally, we have Jess Tyler from Marijuana Business Daily, who's going to be talking about her meeting coming up the end of this month, which is now a virtual meeting, and we'll have a special announcement on how people can participate. So let's get this conversation started.
Want to find out if cannabis can help your medical condition? It's time to hear from our cannabis doctor on call.
Welcome back to the conversation, and joining us today is one of our favorite guests, our America's Cannabis Conversation cannabis doctor on call, Jordan Tischler. Good afternoon, doctor.
Hey, it's good to see you. How are things?
Good. I did fall into a brush pile and scraped up my face pretty good, but I'm recovering. But my maladies are nothing compared to what's happening in the country in some areas. I saw a report, doctor, that last week that there was a concern that the suicide rate in California may be in fact greater than the death rate from the COVID-19 virus killing people. So what I want to talk about is what's happening to these people who've now been on sequester for 4 months or longer, and some who are looking at another month, maybe two, before they can get out of their homes or even proceed the possibility of going back to work. I think this is a huge medical problem that hasn't anything to do with directly with the virus, but the implications of the medical and preventive procedures that we've put in place. So, doctor, what say you?
Well, it isn't a surprise to me at all that suicides would be going up, or that people would be turning to various substances, which unfortunately include opioids, and therefore we would be seeing a rise in both the use of opioids and obviously as a consequence that death related to it. That doesn't surprise me at all. I think that this has been very a tremendous upheaval in everybody's lives, in all quarters of our society, there's no question. But the flip side of that is that I think we're going to have to figure out ways over the next several months to start to address this as a country and as a medical system, because frankly, I don't see us getting out of this kind of quarantine behavior in the near future. And it's complicated because, you know, before COVID, as you are well aware, our mental health system was not very functional and certainly rather taxed already. And then you add on all of this stress and, we're looking at sort of a national PTSD epidemic as a result of this this virus, no question. The best response to that, though, I hope, will be to broaden coverage and to broaden the availability of psychotherapy and other mental health approaches, not necessarily to have everybody kind of throw their hands up in the air and say, look, we can't stand being at home any longer, so let's go out and party on the beach.
Mm-hmm. So if I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate it, I'm not convinced that, and you could certainly correct me if I'm wrong or if you think I'm wrong. I'm not convinced, and I don't want to sound like I'm throwing stones, but I'm not convinced that the protocols that we have seen from the CDC and the dramatic number of changes do this. No, don't do that anymore. Do this. Forget what we said before. Let's do this. The confusion that's coming from the, quote, medical professionals in disease control, masks works, masks don't work. And cloth masks are better than fiber mask. And how often, and, you know, all of these things. I don't see anything coming from the Center for Disease Control, which, again, I could be wrong, doctor, but they've got control of the country at the moment. Now, there are a lot of people who are beginning to question the wisdom of doing that. I wrote a commentary, and I'll just give you the quick cliff notes of it. Why is it after 3.5 months of not wearing a mask did Dr. Burke all of a sudden start wearing a mask? And Dr. Fauci didn't. So I don't understand what goes on in the people in the medical profession who are dealing with viruses, why all of a sudden they've talked about wearing a mask and social distancing, and they clearly try to do that when the president was around and they were there. But just all of a sudden, out of nowhere, 3.5 months into the pandemic, Dr. Burke decides to wear a mask. I think that sends a very confusing message to the American people. You know, what the hell are these people thinking? Because she didn't wear it for 3.5 months, and all of a sudden she is. And so I'm seeing a lot of confusion in the and as a result of the confusion, doctor, trust by the American people into these medical professionals who are trying to tell us what we should do. But the thing that's missing, which you just pointed out, I haven't seen any new initiatives to deal, whether you call it PTSD or depression or anxiety. I haven't seen anything coming out of the Center for Disease Control making recommendations of what people should do who find themselves in a depressed state and have high anxiety. Have you?
No, but I think that there are a few things embedded in your last set of comments that I would like to touch on. The first is there is, I agree, a fair amount of confusion, but part of it is that we weren't prepared for this pandemic. And unfortunately, that's not a CDC issue. That's a higher level policy issue. And we knew that a pandemic was likely to happen at some point, but many of the resources that were necessary in order to prepare for it were eliminated. And what we have learned over the course of the 3.5 months is not enough, but it has shown us, for example, that 6 feet of between people is very difficult to maintain, and it may not be far enough apart. There was a very interesting study that showed that saliva droplets can travel as far as 18 feet if somebody is speaking outside in a light breeze. And so it may be that, you know, and there was a lot of debate about whether non-N95 masks were of any value or not. And I think that there's still some debate around that, but there has been some data that has accumulated that has been helpful, which is to say that the masks can in fact reduce the spread of droplets, and significantly so. But what we don't necessarily know, well, what we think we know is that it doesn't necessarily protect the wearer so much as it protects the people around the wearer. And that then gets into a whole discussion of who is willing to do something for the behalf of the people around them, not just for their own sake. And right. That has presented us with some interesting societal problems that we're seeing, particularly among certain populations who are younger and maybe perhaps a little bit more cavalier about their own health and the health of the people around them. But then they also go back into their communities and bring the virus with them. So I think that, you know, there is only a certain amount that we can know about this virus, given the fact that it's a novel or new virus, and that gleaning the information through science takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of resources. And quite frankly, the CDC has a limited set of resources because of because of the administration, and that's hanging things up. It really is. It's hanging things up. If we wanted a much clearer path, that needs to get done above the level of the director of the CDC. And even the CDC has been politicized in a certain way. As you may recall, about 2-3 weeks ago, the CDC put forth its initial recommendations for consideration of reopening the economy. And the interesting thing about reading that was that they really had made a tremendous number of compromises before that document was even released, meaning that the scientists wanted something far stronger than what got into that document. And the administration turned around and said, no, this is too complicated, right? So the point is that when the scientists speak, they're not being allowed to actually speak. They're being told, you have to come up with something that's easier for us. Well, but this is biology. It is what it is, right? So you can say, oh, we need something simpler. But if it isn't simple, it isn't simple, right? And so there is a problem with our national will to really address this. And there's a fair amount of what I would call wishful thinking out there, that if we just kind of say we're going to reopen the economy, that it'll be okay. But as I say often, this is a virus. It doesn't care what we want. It doesn't think like we do. Its only job is to make more of itself, and it's very good at that. We have to put aside all of the political stuff. We have to put aside our desire to have what we considered normal life beforehand and really simply get in there and do what's necessary to eliminate this virus, which means keep away from each other so that we don't spread it, and put time and money and resources into finding cures and vaccines, because that's what's going to let us get back to it. And unfortunately, anything short of that is again wishful thinking.
Thank you for joining us today, and tell our audience how they can follow the Cannabis Doctor on Call.
Well, thank you, Dan. I certainly enjoy having these discussions together. And if people want to reach me, they can always do so through my website, which is inhalemd.com. Again, inhalemd.com. And there's lots of stuff you can read there about various topics related to cannabis medicine, and you can always reach out to us through the website.
Thank you. If you missed any of this typically terrific interview with Dr. Tesler, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com and download this show and look in the archive section and download other appearances by the good doctor and other people to learn more about the cannabis industry. We'll be right back.
You're listening to America's Cannabis Conversation on W420RadioNetwork.com. Your new cannabis electronic checking account can offer you PIN secure credit and debit cards for your clients. We can place a cashless ATM at your checkout counter, which reduces the amount of cash on hand. Did you know that we can help you bring legacy cash into your new cannabis electronic checking account? No more paying with cash. Making payments with your electronic check is safe and secure. So if you find yourself up at night worrying about somebody breaking in and stealing your cash, consider a cannabis electronic checking account. To find out if a cannabis electronic checking account is right for you, call 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8844. W420RadioNetwork.com.
This is Dan Perkins.
In case you didn't hear all of the interviews in today's conversation, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com to listen to this show. Should you have a question or a comment, please contact us at contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. That's contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. And now, back to the conversation.
Welcome back to the conversation. This is Dan Perkins, and joining us today is Mr. Russell Brunson, who's going to talk to us about his company and what he does, and then we'll talk to him later about his book. But I'm fascinated and about what he does. So, Russell, thank you for joining the conversation today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. We talk to people in the cannabis business, and most of them are small businesses. Some of them are big, but most of them are small moms and pops. Maybe they own one or two stores, but they're not big businesses. And your company seems to be thriving in helping small businesses. And we have a unique situation in the cannabis business, is that social media is an extremely important part of promotion of their products and services to their customers. And it appears to me that in some parts of the country during the pandemic, some of the dispensaries did very well. In other parts of the country, not so much. What's important to me is that the governments in the states decided that the dispensaries were essential businesses. So they were open the whole time, maybe with some restrictions, but they had the ability to connect with their customers. And social media is really important and is increasingly important. So what I'd like to do, sir, if you would tell me and your listeners, tell us a little bit about yourself and then about the business that you have.
Yeah, so, you know, my name is Russell Brunson, like you said, and I'm someone who for the last, almost 18 years of my life now, I've been focusing on helping and serving entrepreneurs, helping them to get their products and their services and their messages out to the world. And it's funny because I spent the first part of my career creating different businesses. I had about 30 different companies. We had supplement companies, and we had information companies and coaching companies and a whole bunch of stuff. And then about almost 6 years ago now, we started teaching entrepreneurs, like, here's how you do it. And a lot of them, like, understood conceptually, but they couldn't figure out the technical parts of it. And so I have an amazing business partner who built a software platform called ClickFunnels that makes it really simple for entrepreneurs and small business owners to create we call sales funnels to sell their products and their services online, or to generate leads. If they've got a local business, to generate leads and get people into their stores as well. And so that's kind of what we do and how we do it, and it's been a ton of fun, and we love serving entrepreneurs and helping them to get their message out to the world.
I would think, Russell, that given the restrictions that have been placed on businesses, big and small, that e-commerce will become an increasing part of their business, but will be an important business strategy that many businesses who have not really paid much attention to their e-commerce model are going to have to spend more attention. What have you noticed have been some of the mistakes that people have made in trying to start their own e-commerce operation?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting because a lot of the mistakes they make is that they're trying to do it the same way that they do their offline business, you know? And they have to understand that, like, when you move online, it actually opens up a bigger world of opportunities. We had one of our members who they have a dance studio, and they have people come in and they do dance classes. And obviously, when the coronavirus hit, their business completely dried up. No one's coming together, not dancing, you know. And they were scrambling, like, what do we do? And their first thought was like, well, let's do online classes and do the same thing. So they started doing that, and they had some success. But at first, it wasn't huge. They had some of their existing members, you know, who were coming to them locally, were like, we'll come and do these virtual ones, and they had success. But they didn't get everybody. But then the big opportunity showed up, where all of a sudden they realized, wait a minute, we're not bound by these geographic locations anymore. We can sell nationwide, and their business just blew up because all of a sudden they could do dance classes everywhere. And now they're looking at, like, do we even go back to, you know, finally, like, it doesn't make any sense now. We should just focus here. And, you know, I have a lot of gym owners who did the same things. They, you know, gym owners weren't considered an essential business in most places. And so they got shut down and they were sitting around not knowing what to do. And I had a lot of friends in that market who started saying, okay, well, let's start doing workouts from home. And they started doing, you know, getting Zoom classes, doing workouts from home. And some of the same kind of thing, they struggled initially at first. They started realizing, like, this is something we can sell around the whole world, not just in our local area. And now a lot of them, their businesses are blowing up. So I think it's understanding some of those nuances of just, like, look, when I'm selling just to people in my zip code, I have these limitations. Whereas when you go bigger, a lot of those limitations disappear. You can start selling everywhere. But you got to figure out how do you package your product in a way that they can be delivered outside of your local area. You know, is it classes? Is it something you ship to people? Like, what's that look like? How's that different? But for the most part, I think it's such a big opportunity for everybody.
So let's say we had a business person that runs a cannabis dispensary in California, and they have a license to do business in the state of California, but they don't have a license to do business anywhere else in the country. So they've got all these dispensaries all over the country are, let's call, for lack of a better description, state-run businesses, which means you've got to stay within a geographical footprint. Challenges are a lot different, where the people can go anywhere in the world. Cannabis people can't go anywhere in the world. They're restricted by a license. Any thoughts on how they might be to be able to change things?
Two things come to mind. Number one, one of the powerful things about the internet is our ability to target. So you can target based on, you know, just show my ads to this zip code or this state or this. So you are able to do that. That's number one. Number two, I've worked in a lot of businesses that have similar restrictions. You know, like where they're only lawyers and things like that, where they're only licensed in a certain state. And so what a lot of these guys do is they'll generate leads online and they set up partnerships with people in other states. So if a lead comes in and they're in California and they get a lead from Nevada that they're not licensed, they have a partner in Nevada they can give that lead to, and then the person in Nevada actually pays them a lead gen cost. Like, well, here's whatever, $100 for that lead that you just sent us. So they're able to make money on the excess that they're not able to use, and then they're giving leads directly to the people who are able to service them in that area. And again, I don't know all the restrictions in the cannabis market, but I would look at something like that. Like, if you're finding partnerships with the other companies, and that way if they get leads that they can't work, but they're in your area, that they can give them to you and vice versa. And that way, if there's the overflow, it's not just wasted. There's a way to still kind of monetize the names.
We're speaking with Russell Brunson, who is a best-selling author and CEO of a $100 million software company called ClickFunnels. Tell us about ClickFunnels.
Yeah, so ClickFunnels is a software platform we created because, you know, when I got started online 15, 16, 17 years ago, it was tough because they didn't have things like Facebook and YouTube, all the ways to nowadays we have to drive traffic. And so we had to do things differently, and we figured out that the best way for small entrepreneurs like me to have success was not by having a big website with a million links and all these things. The most effective way to do it is by having what we call a sales funnel. The sales funnel is just a really simple process, whereas opposed to a website might have links to 100 different pages. A funnel, each page only does one thing. So if you land on a landing page, you might say, hey, if you want a report about, you know, cannabis something something, give me your email address, I'll give you this free report. And the next page would have something that says, okay, let me tell you about my product, and you might sell them on the product. There's only one thing you can do on each page. You take someone through a very basic step-by-step sales process. And so for years, that's what I did, is we were hand-coding these pages and making these things, and that's how I was able to grow so many companies. But then about 5.5, 6 years ago, we decided to make software to make it simple. So that's what ClickFunnels does. It makes creating sales funnels super easy for people like me who are not technical. I can go and I can click on some buttons, I can drag and drop, and I can make something amazing in a matter of minutes. It would have taken, you know, me weeks to hire a designer to try to figure out how to make the same kind of thing.
Well, I, 3 years ago, I'm an author, and I write books, fiction, and I wrote a trilogy on nuclear terrorism against the United States, and started a marketing campaign with Facebook. And very quickly, I got to 150, 175,000 clicks a week. And when it got to 200,000 to 300,000 a week, I was banned from Facebook. And I have, that was 3 years ago. I have appealed every 6 months and I continually get taken down. I can't market any of my books on a Facebook channel. So, but I'm not the only one that's got shut out of the social media because of their particular content. And I wondered if that's going to, if we're going to see a change that's going to make it your job even more important, because you're going to need somebody like yourself to help people understand what they can do and what they can't do and what's the best way to do it going forward.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're always in that thing when trying to navigate, like, what's the big change? What's the, you know, how, what's working today that didn't work yesterday because of, you know, Facebook's algorithms or the legal system changing things, or it's always kind of jumping around, you know, at the whim of what they're changing and trying to keep up with it. So,
right.
It's sad though, especially when someone's got a product or a book or something they care about that they want to get out there, to like not have that ability. Again, they come back to like, do we have free speech in this country? Do we not? And it's definitely a hard topic.
Right. We've been speaking with Russell Brunson from his office, and he's been talking to us about his company and how they help entrepreneurs like him and me improve their presence online. Russell, how do people get a hold of you and follow you?
Yeah, there's a lot of ways. One of the easiest ways, if anyone wants to know more about our software company, ClickFunnels, if you go to clickfunnels.com, you can get a free 2-week trial there and just try it out. You guys can see how simple it is to build a sales funnel. There's a lot of training to help you understand what a sales funnel is and how it works for your specific type of business. But that's kind of the best place to go and start figuring out how to use funnels to grow your company.
Thank you. So we've been talking with Russell, and we're automatically going to invite him back to talk about his new book on a future show. So if you didn't hear all of this great interview with Russell, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com and go to the archive section and download the discussion with Russell or any other show, so you can keep abreast of what's going on in the cannabis industry. Russell, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And we'll be right back.
Introducing the new Cannabis Electronic Checking Account. Did you know that in 2019, almost 1 in 5 dispensaries were either robbed or broken into? Your business is cash only, because up to now, you didn't have access to a banking account that would allow you to deposit the daily receipts from your business. Some owners have started a banking relationship only to be told in a few months that the institution was closing the account. For the first time, you can now have a reliable business checking account. Yes, I said a secure bank electronic checking account. For more information, call 1-888-420-8844 and ask for Dan Perkins. That's 888-420-8884 and ask for Dan Perkins. W420RadioNetwork.com.
This is Dan Perkins. In case you didn't hear all of the interviews in today's conversation, you can go to W420RadioNetwork.com to listen to this show. Should you have a question or a comment, please contact us at contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. That's contact@W420RadioNetwork.com. And now, back to the conversation.
Welcome back to the conversation today. And joining us is our good friend from the National Cannabis Industry Association, Morgan Fox. And he's here to talk to us today about a friend of the court brief that they have filed in a lawsuit with Harborside in Oakland, California. Morgan, tell us about what you've done and why you've done it.
Well, just a little bit of background on the case. Harborside, as most of you viewers probably know, is one of the oldest and largest and most well-respected cannabis businesses in the country, operating in Oakland for probably about a decade now, if not longer. And because of the 280E tax code, they've been unable to deduct business expenses like every other business is able to do, creating an effective tax rate of anywhere from 50 to 70% on the federal level. And that's in addition to all the state taxes and local taxes that these businesses have to file. So they decided to take the IRS to court over this. And in 2018, their overall appeal was rejected, although their tax bill was significantly decreased. But still left them saddled with an $11 million back taxes bill. They've now appealed that decision, and NCIA and several other groups have been filing amicus briefs in that case to help to bolster their case against the federal government and hopefully get a ruling that not only helps Harborside, but helps all cannabis businesses in that district and provides a precedent for cannabis businesses nationwide.
Morgan, do you think if the – I think you told me this was going into the Ninth Circuit, the appeal?
This is going to be in I believe in the Ninth Circuit, yeah.
Yeah. So if you get a favorable ruling, are you anticipating that the IRS would file to the Supreme Court?
It's entirely possible. I think it would really just depend on their appetite for this case. And, you know, right now they're – isn't a whole lot of political pressure to reform 280E, but whether or not the IRS decides that they want to continue fighting this battle that they are eventually going to be legislated into a losing position on, I think is something that they have to seriously consider. And even this case, in its current location, is probably going to take at least a year for there to be any judgment rendered.
Something about what you said struck me as having to ask this question. If I would have to pay in California, if I would have to pay up to 70% federal taxes plus the state taxes in California, and I'm not trying to be facetious, Morgan, why would I want to be in the business in California?
Well, I mean, that's a question that a lot of people have, and it's one of the reasons why it's so difficult to get legacy businesses into the regulated market. You know, these sort of tax bills basically make it impossible to even keep a business alive and operating in the red, let alone be profitable. So it's something that a lot of people have to contend with. That doesn't mean that it's not possible to be successful under these restrictions, but it's much more difficult. And the returns and margins under such a tax scheme are just a fraction of what they could be. And that hurts all sorts of things, from development to employment to payroll.
So do you think, Morgan, that because California and the 33 states that authorize medical marijuana, the vast majority of them, if not all of them, designated them as critical businesses, given the situation where they were essential businesses, does that swing the story at all? Do you think?
I certainly think that it should. Government tax collection bodies are usually kind of blind to a lot of these things. They just want their cut. So it's difficult to know whether or not they will be taking the side of these businesses, and I tend to think not. But it's a very valid point, particularly as state budgets are stretched thin because of the pandemic response. Vitally important to keep these businesses open, but if federal taxes are making it impossible for them to do so, then state coffers are going to hurt just as much as these businesses.
Yeah, I know that I've read story after story after story about people who were able to continue to get their medicines from their dispensary because even if they had to go to drive through or drive up and they were able to continue to get their medication, and there was a thought early on that there was a lot of, because there was a spike up in volume, there was a lot of panic buying being concerned, but that's gone away. And actually, I read a report recently that said that in general, sales are up about 20% over last year and above expectation.
Well, I think that that can be explained by a number of factors, but its effect is really marginal when you take into account the additional costs and strains of continuing to operate under COVID restrictions, as well as the already onerous financial burdens that are placed on cannabis businesses, even in the normal times. So I think that there's a misconception that because the cannabis business is marginal increases in sales during the pandemic, that everything is hunky-dory, when in fact that's not the case. And unfortunately, we're not only running into that problem among the IRS, but also in Congress, where being treated fairly is being viewed as asking for a handout, and that's just not the case. And the cannabis industry in general is only asking to have the same ability to deduct business expenses and other nonprofit items from their taxes, just like any other business.
So if we look
that's
at it,
that's actually one of the core arguments of our amicus brief, is that this sort of taxation basically amounts to a form of punishment against the cannabis industry, and that the level at which it's being punished is also a violation of the Eighth Amendment's excessive clauses or excessive fines clause.
So is this also a possibility? I'm not a lawyer, but is this discrimination too?
So far, I haven't seen any 14th Amendment arguments being placed against that, and it's questionable whether they would be successful, but I think that it's definitely something to be considered. As an industry, though, I think that it's pretty clear that the cannabis industry is being punished by the IRS, and that's something that we need to stop immediately if we want to see this industry survive and thrive and continue to generate both state and tax revenue effectively, as well as to provide jobs and critical infrastructure.
You made a really good point that I want to follow up on, and that was the fact that revenue from the sale of this product helps the state coffers at a time when their cupboard is bare. But if we start losing businesses because the owners can't make any money and they shut them down, they're going to start losing tax revenue from the cannabis industry.
Absolutely. And it's not just about tax revenue. It's also incentivizing the illicit market. That's another thing that we brought up in our brief, that if we really want to create more tax revenue for both the state and the federal government in the long term, we need to do everything we can to make sure that cannabis businesses that are regulated are viable and sustainable financially. And, you know, that means that by decreasing the tax burden, overall, more sales will take place in the legal regulated market, and in the long run, will increase the overall tax haul that both states and the federal government are receiving from the cannabis industry. And trying to squeeze blood out of a stone, whether it be at the state or federal level, is really short-sighted.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was just thinking about you were just answering that question. If we need to talk a little bit about how concerned is your association with the possibility that many businesses cannabis businesses might go out of business, not only for the tax revenue, but as you said, in some cases it was marginally, in other cases it was down. There, I saw an article where there were several big dispensaries in San Francisco were laying off people. Are we looking at a possibility of contraction in the industry?
I think we're absolutely going to see that, both in the short and long term, unless these problems are addressed. And, you know, we've seen during the pandemic that the businesses that have done the best are those who had access to capital, which is a very small percentage of the overall cannabis industry and directly related to the inability to access traditional lending through banking. All of this stuff is tied together. And so I think that unless we see real reforms in the very near future, there's going to be a lot of contraction and a lot of smaller businesses are going to suffer.
So we've got about a minute left, Morgan. Give us a time sequence on this court case. What do you think is the timeline?
Well, it'll probably be about a year, if not more, before this case is actually adjudicated. It's really tough to tell based on the number of cases that are coming in, and you know, a lot of other factors that keep the courts busy, as well as the parties involved extremely busy. So it might be a while before we have any answers to that. And as you said, it's entirely possible that if Harborside wins, that the IRS will appeal. So I don't think that we've seen the end of this story by a long shot, but it's certainly something that needs to be watched very closely.
Thank you for joining us, Morgan. Please tell our audience how they can follow this litigation and how they can get in touch with you and follow the industry.
But, there's plenty of information available on the court case via Harborside, as well as through the law firms of Greenstone Martyr and Frickin' Tilly. And you can find out more information about anything cannabis and policy related through our website at thecannabisindustry.org. And we're also available on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn and Twitter.
We've been speaking with Morgan Fox of the National Cannabis Industry Association, talking about the lawsuit against the IRS and Harborside. Thank you for joining us today, Morgan.
Thanks for having me.
America's newest and fastest growing cannabis-focused radio network is expanding across the country and looking to add to our sales and marketing team. America's Cannabis Conversation offers listeners insight and information on the exploding world of cannabis. It also gives advertisers the opportunity to reach a hyper-targeted audience, literally neighborhood by neighborhood, in markets all across the country. We're looking for a few motivated individuals that want to essentially run their own local business in markets like Boston, Las Vegas, Reno, Orlando, and more. To learn more about this exciting opportunity or to apply, visit americascannabisconversation.com.
This is Dan Perkins, and I want to tell you about a limited-time offer for our listeners. MJ BizCon will take place from June 29th to July 1st in a virtual environment, and you can join the conference and save $25 on the cost of admission. Just go to W420RadioNetwork.com and look for the discount offer. Click on it, it'll take you to the registration site, and make sure you use your discount code and enjoy the conference. Stay tuned as we hope to have some of the presenters on our show in the coming weeks. This is Dan Perkins.
Welcome back to the conversation. Joining us today is Jess Tyler from Marijuana Business Daily. She has a unique job. She's a conference planner, among other things. And they had this big conference was going to come out, and they've decided to try it virtually. Jess, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
So you have this almost impossible task. As I recall, this particular meeting, the last time it was done, had thousands upon thousands of people who came to the meeting, and you had convention space, and you had exhibitors, and you had all the traditional markings of a typical business show. But you can't do that now. You're trying to save the opportunity by doing a virtual meeting. Tell us about what it's going to look like.
Yeah, absolutely. This is actually really exciting for us to expand and try something new. Our event, MJ BizCon Next, co-located with the Hemp Industry Daily Conference, was supposed to be last week, actually, in New Orleans. And given the coronavirus pandemic, we haven't been able to have it. So we made the decision a couple months ago to pivot to having this online. And virtual events, they've been around for, at least 15 years. And I remember in the, 2008 to 2010 time frame, virtual events were becoming, they said they was the next big thing. With the economic crisis, the recession, face-to-face is dead. Everything in the future is going to be virtual. Working in the event industry at that time, that was a little scary. What we found was the virtual really didn't catch on. But I think what really is a big difference between what we went through in 2008 and what we're looking at right now is that, first of all, no events are happening right now. And there that need to connect with other people in your industry and the need to continue to get education and share ideas, that's still there. Coupled with the fact that now technology has come so far, especially in the virtual event space, there are so many platforms that are out there right now that really allow the benefits and the value that we get out of a face-to-face event to come through with what we're doing on the computer. And with everyone at home right now, on our Zoom calls and interacting digitally, I think that this is becoming more of the way that we'll see things moving forward. However, I still believe that hybrid events will be the next wave. So face-to-face will come back, but with a virtual component. So to kick that off, with our MJ BizCon Next and Hemp Industry Daily Conference, we've taken them to our now MJ Biz Daily Direct series. We are bringing all of the content, all of the networking direct to our audience, wherever they might be in the world. This platform that we are using, we've brought in some really good technology partners to help us build this, where we will feature live content, speaker Q&As, one-to-one networking and interactions, chats between attendees with speakers, and then we'll have virtual expo halls as well, broken into a few different categories by the exhibitor's product type, so extraction or cultivation products, packaging, CBD, dispensary retail, software. And you'll be able to get to know these exhibitors, see what products they have to offer, communicate directly with a sales rep in the booth, just as you would at home. So it's very, very exciting, and the event kicks off on the 29th.
So when you had this, Jess, when you had this event last year, was it 3 days, 2 days?
3 days.
How many people participated in the 3 days?
Last year, we had just around, I think, 4,000 attendees total.
And so what can you handle in a virtual format this year?
This year, we are expecting, we have room up to 100 exhibiting companies, and we expect around 750 attendees for this year in the virtual environment.
And in the 750 in the virtual environment, are you pressing it, or do you still have a lot of room?
We have room. I think right now we are approaching this with trying to meet people with where they are and understanding that this is a new environment. We are trying something new. And this concept is new, not just to the cannabis industry, but honestly to the event industry. So we have room. We could have more, but that's what we're expecting right now.
So you said that at some point in time, you're going to be able to have live in person, but you intimated that there's going to be a hybrid model, which will also allow for virtual content. The reason why I'm interested in this is that my son, one of my four sons, is an investment banker, and he is in private practice doing employee stock purchase plans. And he said to me maybe a month and a half ago, that because of where he lives in Washington, in the Washington, D.C. area, and the travel restrictions, he's not able to go out and see potential prospects. So he's looking for alternatives of how he can interface with these prospects who still have a need to want to sell their businesses. So going from 4,000 to 750 sounds like a huge drop, but in my mind, 750 is an astronomical number. How do you, what is the experience that you expect to happen at this first shot?
I believe that this is going to meet the needs of our cannabis audience for this first time around and what they're going through right now. The agenda, we completely retooled it to be focused more on exactly what are these cannabis executives and entrepreneurs dealing with right now. So we're looking at things like how to manage your business through an economic downturn, or how to pivot your business to take advantage of all of these new digital opportunities. So having that educational component that is so timely and so relevant, coupled with being able to make those connections at a live event, so often you rely on that serendipitous connection of meeting someone new that could turn into a future piece of business for you or a future partner or employee. And we've really put a lot of thought into the networking component of this to ensure that those types of connections can still happen. Webinars, you know, they continue to happen and they're available and they're great content. But the piece that we're really focusing on supplying to our attendees and our exhibitors is being able to make those connections. So even down to, we will have a place where, based on your current interests and your background in the cannabis industry, we will recommend connections to you to have meetings with someone with similar interests or that could support your business. And trying to facilitate those connections and the networking is really a huge focus of ours. So for the attendees and our exhibitors, I anticipate that they will have a very similar result in what they get out of the event that they would at a physical event. But this way, it'll just be all shifting online.
One of the major concerns of the industry is security. The number of cannabis dispensaries that were destroyed, raided, and looted was frightening to the industry in general. And there are two reasons for that. One is Jesse James was asked why he robbed banks, and he said, because that's where the money is. We know that the cannabis business is a cash business, and that's where the money is. And number two, going along with that, is that we need banking reform. So are either of those subjects being covered in your conference?
That's really interesting. So for our conference, we're focused more about running your business and being able to transition and pivot through a really difficult time and unprecedented time that we're going through right now. As far as specifics on exactly what's being covered within each session, I would have to defer to my content team a little bit more on that, but I can get back to you.
Okay. So let me ask you, if you would take a moment in the few seconds that we have left in this segment, how can people get information about the conference? When is it, and how do they get a hold of you, and then how do they follow your industry publications?
Absolutely. So you can learn more about MJ BizCon Next Direct at mjbizconference.com. That is where we have all of our events, including our December MJ BizCon in Las Vegas. And you can reach out to me directly if you have any questions or would like to follow up at all at jess.tyler@mjbizdaily.com. We do have a daily e-newsletter and monthly print publication that you can check out on mjbizdaily.com.
And give me the date again.
MJ BizCon Next Direct will be June 29th through July 1st.
Okay, super. We've been speaking to Jess Tyler, and thank you for joining us today on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So if you missed any part of this conversation with Jess, you can go to w420radionetwork.com and go to the archive section and listen to this and other content on the show. We'll be right back.
Thank you for taking part in America's Cannabis Conversation. To hear this show in its entirety or to hear any of our archive shows, log on to americascannabisconversation.com and tune in next Saturday at 4:20 p.m. for the next installment of America's Cannabis Conversation.
America's Cannabis Conversation.